Good afternoon and welcome to the Athenaeum. I'm the speech-impaired director of the Athenaeum, Peter Kahn. I'll be brief. According to Larry Platt, public discourse is at an all-time low, and civic engagement is in peril. Co-founder of the Philadelphia Citizen, a nonprofit solutions-oriented news site, Larry suggests that the city needs a new narrative, one that goes beyond our usual litany of grievances and focuses on ideas that could move us forward. Founding the Philadelphia Citizen, or co-founding it in 2015, he envisioned it as a tool, quote, to get regular citizens off the sidelines to take back their city. Larry is a New York Times best-selling author and the former editor of both Philadelphia Magazine and the Philadelphia Daily News. His subject today is reinvigorating citizenship in the birthplace of American democracy. Welcome, Larry Platt.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much, Peter. What a great turnout on a hot day. I appreciate everyone being here. A couple of notes before I make some remarks, and then we can have a conversation. First of all, it's great to see some old friends here, and I want to acknowledge them. Ed Bronstein. Let me tell you a little story about Ed Bronstein, who I never met until just now. But about 2 years ago, when I started the Citizen, former Governor Rendell called me. It was after Hillary Clinton lost to some real estate developer. And the governor said, I'm really depressed, and I'm wondering if you can help me. He said, I'm trying to get myself out of this funk, and I'm trying to do that by playing jokes on people. And so I've told a friend of mine, who I've known for years, who I work out with at the sporting club, that you at the Citizen do a feature and want to do a feature on him called Seriously Sexy Over 60. And that victim of this joke was Ed Bronstein. So I, of course, interviewed Ed and then did up a whole dummy copy with photos and everything, his head photoshopped on a bodybuilder's body, and made a copy of it just to give to the governor so he could get a laugh and deal with the disappointment of the 2016 election. But in the process, and I later said this to the governor, in talking to Ed, I was really enriched by the way he spoke about his wife, and I understand 50 years together, which alone should make you a candidate for president. And finally, really happy to see former Mayor Green here, who I just saw on Election Day for lunch, our annual lunch. Mayor Green was mayor for 4 years and had the good sense to get out. And I always respected that about the mayor. So my name is Larry Platt, and I am a recovering journalist. I'm an author, the former editor, as Peter said, of Philadelphia Magazine, the Philadelphia Daily News. But as I approached 50 years old, rather than start driving around in a Jaguar convertible, I took a hard look at the sorry state of our democracy and the role my industry, journalism, has played in kind of numbing our citizenry into apathy. And so, with help from some civic-minded leaders and a small band of like-minded disruptors, we started the Philadelphia Citizen, a nonprofit that reports on solutions, hosts problem-solving events, and really agitates for nonpartisan civic change. So why is something like the Citizen so needed? Well, we're a few blocks from that basement at 7th and Market, where a 32-year-old Thomas Jefferson wrote the first draft of our founding document. I'd wager that he'd be aghast today and see if he were here to see what took place last week. The mayor and I were just talking about this. We had an election. About 240,000 of our fellow citizens in a city of 1.5 million showed up to vote. Not even the bare minimum our founders had envisioned, at least among male white landowners. And this is what really gets me. That was reported as good news. Local elections matter. Voter turnout wows Philly in 2019. Seriously, 23% voter turnout in the city where American democracy was born is worthy of a wow? Talk about the soft bigotry of low expectations. And voting is only the most easily measured metric of the sad state of our civic participation. Last year, the Corporation for National and Community Service released a report and found that 34% of Philadelphians volunteer, while a mere 22% do something positive for their neighborhoods. Now, there are many reasons for why this is, right? You've heard them all. There's gerrymandering when it comes to the vote. There's the coercive effect of money in politics. There's even, as Robert Putnam so eloquently wrote in his seminal book a few years ago, Bowling Alone, the disintegration of bowling leagues from American life, whether it's bowling and softball leagues, the church, or newspapers, institutions that once knit us together have frayed. And here's where my industry, the news business, comes in. If the railroads of yesteryear had realized they were in the transportation business and not the railroad business, our airlines today would be named the Atchison, the Topeka, and the Santa Fe. And if our newspapers had realized they were in the community business and in the problem-solving business and not just in the information business, once glorious brand names like the Philadelphia Inquirer, which just announced another round of buyouts and the potential for yet more layoffs, they wouldn't be lost in this death spiral narrative. People have decided that their votes don't count. And as an editor of a major metropolitan newspaper when I was at the Daily News, I started to feel complicit. We practiced the stenography of who said what yesterday, often in mind-numbing detail. We dug for scandal, never stopping to think that we might also, at that same moment, be fueling cynicism. And worse, we gave you a steady diet of ephemera, designed to get you addicted to clicking that mouse time and time again. I challenge you to go on philly.com and easily find a compendium of the votes your elected representative has cast on your behalf. But with one click, you can find thousands of words about this guy. That's the Flyers mascot, Gritty, of course. Many written as if he were actually a sentient human being. The era of online news has only made things worse. Here's how it worked when I was at the Daily News. About two or three times a week, I'd put an unflattering photo of then-Eagles coach Andy Reid on the cover, along with some snarky headline, like WTF, one of the most highest-selling covers in history, or some double entendre about his weight, right? Once we settled on the image and cover line, we'd email it over to WIP's Angelo Cataldi, that paragon of virtue there, so he could talk about it at 7 a.m. the next morning on his highly rated morning zoo-type sports talk radio show. By the time I got to the newsroom, I'd have a report on my desk on how many clicks our journalism had gotten that morning. This is not to criticize my brethren in the newsroom, all good, smart folks. It is to say that in the for-profit online news game, you are incentivized to provide precisely the kind of public narrative our city doesn't need. One that, when not focused on utter trivia, sells the scandal du jour. When what we need is a focus on ideas that can move us forward, and we also need a little help in how we can be better local patriots. So the genesis of my thinking in developing the Citizen came one night in 2007 when I was asked to interview the late, great Norman Mailer at a free library event. At the cocktail reception beforehand, I found myself huddled in conversation with the legendary author. He was, by now, a kindly old man, unsteady on his feet. I peppered Mailer with questions, right? We talked about the March on the Pentagon in 1967, which was the setting of his, what I think is his greatest book, Armies of the Night, which was a stinging critique of establishment journalism. He was charming, self-deprecating. There was little of the rebellious, pugnacious spirit, there it is, that had come to be his calling card. Until, that is, we segued to the subject of newspapers, which were already being imperiled back then. In the 60s, Mailer had founded the Village Voice because something new was desperately needed. And he wanted to know, where was today's journalistic disruption? They get what they deserve, he spat out to me when I brought up the subject of newspapers. When was the last time you read something in a newspaper, even in the vaunted New York Times, that made you think? America is allergic to ideas, he said, and that's not unrelated to the principal failing of journalism. It's as if they don't see it as their mission to publish anything interesting or stimulating or challenging. So I say let them go. Good riddance. Well, I wasn't about to argue with him. This was a dude who once stabbed his own wife, after all, and who headbutted Gore Vidal on The Dick Cavett Show. Yes, I was afraid of an 80-year-old man of letters. But during my reign at the Daily News, I thought often of Mailer's critique. The newspaper industry had gone from a $20 billion industry to a $60 billion business between 1960 and 2000, and it took just the next 10 years to revert back to a $20 billion industry. Think of that. That's a metric that tells you you're doing something wrong. Now, the conventional wisdom in the newsroom about this crisis facing journalism was tellingly lacking in introspection. The internet was the villain. It stole classified ads, and when publishers put their content on the internet for free, a golden opportunity for revenue had been blown. But there were problems with this otherwise convenient excuse. The contraction in advertising dollars and circulation actually began before the advent of the internet. As Mailer pointed out, the problem was the product itself. It too often did not delight. When times were good, publishers and journalists were stuck in place due to hubris. When things got bad, they were paralyzed due to fear and a type of collective anger. When the economy tanked, advertisers started to realize what would happen if they didn't advertise. Nothing. And that placing ads on websites was not akin to ads in a newspaper due to the new medium's lack of contiguousness, right? Ads in a newspaper are part and parcel of the editorial experience. Advertisers also saw that readers were leaving newspapers in droves. The market was speaking, and it was telling editors and reporters that it didn't like what they were producing. I said as much to the Daily News staff on that day in 2011 when I first addressed them. I ran through the numbers for them. I told them that 25 years ago, their circulation was 280,000. 18 years ago, here we go, 18 years ago, 195,000. 2 years ago, 97,000. On that day, it was down to 80,000, plummeting daily. Today, it's less than 30,000. No one had shared with the staff these incontrovertible metrics that spoke to the ongoing rejection of their product. That couldn't just be about the internet, right? Clearly, something they were doing wasn't connecting with their fellow citizens. And there's that word again, citizen. To me, that was the missing part of the puzzle. Journalism is the one industry in America singled out in our founding document as vital for the future of the republic. So maybe it's time we rethink the philosophical underpinnings of journalism itself. After all, the last time the fundamental precepts of journalism underwent significant revision was in the 1800s, when the notion of objectivity took hold. A change, interestingly enough, that was driven by advertiser wishes rather than any desire to serve the citizen any better. That neutral, on the one hand, on the other voice is what's given us those BS, does global warming exist debates, evidence be damned. So imagine instead a journalism with a fiduciary-type responsibility only to the citizen, a journalism that elevates the public discussion instead of playing the clickbait game, a journalism that introduces you to someone like Cornetta Lane, a young African-American woman in Detroit who founded Pedal to Porch, a nonprofit that eases the tensions of gentrification. She formed bike tours, taking gentrifiers through their new neighborhoods, stopping at the porches of longtime residents, and thereby reducing the tensions of gentrification and forging real connections in neighborhoods that were undergoing vast change. Imagine a journalism that with each story contains a do something option. Click on it to find ways you can make your city better. Sign a petition, attend a community meeting, sweep a street, be a citizen. A journalism that practices the most old-fashioned type of social networking, actually bringing folks together, as we have come together today, to discuss ideas that can move a city forward. That's our Ideas We Should Steal Festival last November. It's an annual event. That's Ali Velshi of MSNBC who, on the far right, who's on our board, Anand Giridharadas, the author, and in the middle, that's Chris Hughes, the co-founder of Facebook, who recently garnered a lot of headlines with his departure, shall we say, and critique of Facebook. So imagine a journalism that not only brings together smart people sharing ideas for change, but also offers financial incentives to groups or individuals to do good. We offer a $50,000 annual prize named after our founding chairman, Jeremy Nowak, to solve a city problem. Imagine a journalism that still serves the vital role of watchdog, absolutely, but that is also a force for civic good. Journalism, after all, as the founders knew, is like clean air and clean water, a public good. So why not treat it as a means to the end of robust civic engagement? You know, in a 1903 magazine article, legendary journalist Lincoln Steffens famously called Philadelphia corrupt and contented. Back then, as now, Philly was a one-party machine town. In his piece, a local ward leader explains to Steffens why our city so rapidly followed each stunning act of public malfeasance with yet more public malfeasance. It turns out, it then as now, it was actually a strategy. We reasoned, he said, that if we did exactly as we wanted fast enough, one, two, three, one after the other, the papers couldn't handle them all, and the public would be stunned and give up. We know that public despair is possible and that that is good politics. Well, how things change. Remember that 23% at the polls last week? That's not just an indictment of our political leaders and the electorate. It's also a commentary on the role journalism has played in numbing a citizenry into apathy. Opinion polls show journalists are held in lower regard than Congress and used car salesmen. Yes, the New York Times and Washington Post are publishing important investigations of the Trump administration, but information alone won't save the republic. We need a new narrative. both nationally and locally. Storytelling is as old as our history, and we need stories that, rather than making citizens mad or depressed, fill them with possibility. My wife is a second grade school teacher, and she talks movingly about the sheer beauty of the dawning of an idea spreading across a child's face. Well, that's what we all need. We need to read or listen or watch the stories around us and say to ourselves something we too seldom say. Huh, what an interesting idea. I never thought of that before. If we do that, if we resurrect ideas and possibility and action all in the public square, we will have reinvigorated democracy in the American city where it was born. And with that, we can toss this around, kick this around. Thank you. Thank you. Thoughts, comments, am I crazy? Yes, sir. So we're a nonprofit and it's not a paper, it's online solely, a nonprofit with multiple revenue streams. About 40% of our funding come from foundations, one in particular, membership, donors, and corporate sponsorship. So the Ideas We Should Steal Festival was sponsored by Comcast, FS Investments, Campus Apartments, a couple of foundations, Knight Foundation and Independence Blue Cross. That's another of the innovations. The sort of journalism success stories are few and far between in this crazy world we live in, but the ones that seem to be working are these ones that value community and are not just advertiser-driven. So the two that I'll reference and that have been models for us is TexasTribune.org in Texas. Started by Evan Smith, who is the former editor of Texas Monthly, the analog of Philadelphia Magazine in Texas. They're in about their 10th year, they're in the black, very similar setup. And the other one is minpost.org, Minnesota Post in Minnesota, being run by Andy Putz, who was an editor for me at the Daily News, and is now in his native Minnesota, doing a great job. Same sort of funding mechanism. But what they both do is value a public square. The Texas Tribune does 62 public events a year, and it's people coming together to talk about problems and to work on solving them. So we're entering our fourth year, we're still trying to figure it out. But the cool thing is that when you've never done something before, you can just try stuff. And that's what's really been fun about this experiment. Yes, sir? That was just the print circulation. And let me talk to you for a minute about online. So Philly.com does have big numbers. When I was there, it was 7 million unique visitors a month, I guess. A month, but at an average time on site at about 22 seconds, right? Because people are going to look, they're either coming through social or coming through Google to look for one specific thing. This is not a way to educate the populace. And on top of that, there's no business model for those kind of numbers. In other words, at the dawn of the internet, advertisers would ask, well, how many unique visitors are you getting? And what advertisers have realized is they can't monetize. You can say 7 million, but there's no return on that investment. So consequently, the price of advertising on Philly.com has gone way down because advertisers, you know, the market has spoken. Advertisers weren't seeing the return on that investment. So the model has broken. Yes, ma'am. Sure, great questions. So the website gets about 50 to 60,000 unique visitors a month, which is good. What we're most excited about is when we've done reader user surveys is the demographics. It's people like you, highly educated, thoughtful, smart people, engaged. So that's one. But the thing we were most excited about is that 58% reported that they had done something in the last year to make their city better as a result of reading about it on The Citizen. And because that's really what we are. We're and it's why I joke pseudo jokingly say I'm a recovering journalist. Our goal is not to commit journalism. Our goal is to use journalism as an end towards a more vibrant democracy. So when we can get people out of their comfort zone to do stuff, even if it's cleaning a city street or what have you, we count that as a success. A couple things on the come to mind on the issue of those kind of like mini successes. Well, one was when we started, and we should have done this year, but we just didn't have the time. We did twice a voter lottery. In which we gave away $10,000 to a random voter on election day. You'd show up to the polls, and there I am with a giant check like Ed McMahon giving you $10,000 for doing your civic duty. And the idea behind this was and when we announced it, we had Sam Katz and John Street at a press conference to say, we don't think this is the answer. Paying people to vote is not the answer, but when you're in a civic crisis, all hands should be on deck, and this is worth trying. So we did this twice, and we engaged a pollster both cases afterwards. And in both cases, the pollster found that of the 30% of the electorate who knew about the voter lottery, turnout was up in the first case, I believe it was 8%, and in the second case, 5%. So we moved the needle in those two experiments. And this has been tried a couple other times. Los Angeles, there was a school board election that also moved the needle on turnout. It's a shame that you have to incentivize people in this day and age to turn out. And then there are others who say, but what if you're getting low information voters who just show up to have the chance to win a lottery? By the way, your chances of winning our $10,000 was much higher given our low voter turnout than any other lottery known to man. But we say we should be experimenting with all sorts of we want to call it a gimmick, fine, but we should be experimenting with anything that can move the needle and take us out of our comfort zone in terms of solutions to what really is a crisis in civic participation. A couple other things occur to me. This was a small thing, but it's an example of why we are passionate about what we're doing. In the aftermath of the Trump election, people were newly energized, right? A lot of people were suddenly long dormant activists. And we got a call from a reader saying, I'm in a knitting group. A bunch of us, it was a middle-aged woman, a bunch of us knit, and we want to do something. We're not going to go march on Washington, but we want to do something. Can we knit mittens for the homeless? And we actually have on our staff, small, very lean and mean staff, but someone whose title includes being a social impact director. That sounds like a big title, but it's a kid who eats ramen noodles three times a day. So he said, well, hold off, let me make a few calls and get back to you. So he called around to homeless shelters and did a little legwork, got back to her. It turns out that I think what was needed was scarves and socks, right. He found out the need and the point of contact, and that group today is still knitting socks for the homeless. So at a very grassroots level, that's what being a citizen is about. And the whole idea is, let's make it a little bit easier, just a little bit, for people to do good. And they will. or some will, and that's to all our benefit. Yes, sir. Yeah. I haven't done much in terms, I'm interested in, this is sort of a coming out for me, talking about this. So I'd be interested in talking to any group that you have, that anyone here knows about, to sort of talk about this idea now that we've tested it and have the results that we have. But we have covered a lot of neighborhood issues, because really the ongoing challenge is if the citizen is just a bunch of Center City liberals all talking to each other, it's not what the city needs. So we do a lot of neighborhood coverage, and reporters deal with civic groups all the time. Yes. We're at a the question was, do you have young people involved? So we're at a co-working space at Broad and Locust. I am by far the oldest person in this place, and which is really an interesting experience. On the one hand, it's energizing. On the other, on the day that Bob Dylan won the Nobel Prize and I was all excited, I just got blank stares. And that's what is really exciting about this moment in Philadelphia. Philadelphia is being changed by new eyes, by fresh eyes, by young people who are coming here and sort of asking the questions that newcomers ask. In the political realm, it's like, wait, why do I need a permission from a ward leader to run for office? And what's a ward leader? So I don't think you would have been able to do an exercise like the Citizen 10 years ago. Philadelphia's among the premier destinations in the country for millennials who, while they don't vote, are the most active generation in terms of volunteering, in terms of civic engagement. We've let them down by devaluing the power of their vote. But I'm actually very excited about the future of Philadelphia because young people are being driven here. Now, there's a challenge there, right? If we don't come up with jobs, they're not gonna stay. And if we don't fix the schools, they're not gonna stay. But that's a good challenge to have, as opposed to 20 years ago when the brain drain was draining all the talent out of Philadelphia, and largely that stopped. Really smart questions. What else? Yes, ma'am. Yeah. Great question. We tried to be a curator for you on that. We did a series called New Blood, where we profiled new people who were running for political office, but not all of them. We sifted through them and tried to pick the ones that we thought offered the most change, but the most realistic sense of change. And I'm happy to say that one of them won. That was Jamie Gauthier, who is running against Janie Blackwell for city council. Blackwell has reigned in city council for 45 years, and Janie Blackwell's done some good things, but 45 years is enough, right? FDR only got what, 16? 13. So Roxanne Patel Shepalavi, our executive editor, who's here, did a great story on Rochelle Bilal, the woman running against the sheriff. Who won? Yeah, it was terrific. Now, we shouldn't have a sheriff. It should be an appointed position. But if you're going to have a sheriff, it ought not to be someone with 3 sexual harassment claims against him, right? So we did that. We published a guide, an election guide, about a week before the election, to try and make it a little easier for you to go through all this stuff. The real shame of the city, and they're numerous, but is the way we elect judges, right? No one knows anything about them. They're largely dependent upon ballot position. So we at least gave the American Bar Association offers recommended and highly recommended, and we at least tried to get disseminate that information. So then the last thing I'll say about our election approach was to not get too bogged down in the sort of daily he said, she said, and take a step back and try and talk about vision. Try and decipher who has ideas for the city. And one of the things Mayor and I were talking about this on election day that I thought was shameful was that we had a mayoral election. There was a debate. There was none of the three candidates had a vision for the future of Philadelphia. They were all poll tested, but there was no, what's the plan? What's the 5-year plan? Okay, Jim Kenney, you just raised spending 25%, the largest increase in spending in our history. What is our return on that investment? And what's nothing? There, that was not a debate. And so we at least tried to raise these questions and tried to look at other options elsewhere. So I've written a lot about, has anyone heard of Lori Lightfoot? So Lori Lightfoot came out of nowhere to become the mayor of Chicago last week. So think about this. About a month or so before the election, a powerful city councilman, Edward Burke in Chicago, gets indicted by the feds. His office gets raised. They have councilmanic prerogative, which basically gives their councilmen, like ours, indiscriminate power, district councilmen, indiscriminate power over land deals in development in their districts. So this councilman was, Burger King wanted a zoning change to do renovations, or wanted a license. So he required them to A, hire his law firm, B, give a sizable political donation to Tony Preckwinkle, the machine candidate for mayor. The feds indict him, and it gives rise to the little-known Lori Lightfoot, who runs against this privilege. Chicago rises up and elects her mayor, a true reformer. Now, what does she do? Last week, she gets inaugurated, goes to her office, and signs a executive order directing city planning, zoning, and licensing, city agencies, to no longer defer to council on matters of land disposition. So effectively ending councilmanic prerogative. Where's our Lori Lightfoot? Is my question for Philadelphia. And we saw some of that strain in some of these young candidates this time out, but it's going to be an uphill climb. Any other thoughts, questions? Can I ask? Oh, go ahead. Yes, we're excessively local. We will localize national issues, you know, but there has to be some local. I think that's one of the reasons newspapers got in the trouble they're in, because from a content perspective, reporters got a little carried away with themselves and drawn to the national scene, and local and state issues and governments have not been covered. And there's a lot happening here. I am consistently pleasantly surprised by the content our guys come up with that doesn't exist elsewhere. We have this recurring feature, Ideas We Should Steal, in which we find innovative solutions in other cities. Because I should say that cities are the premier laboratory of experiment throughout the world right now. By 2054, 80% of the world will live in metropolitan areas. And that's what's so interesting about Mayor Pete, right? Because there, as he says, and we had him here in February before he blew up for a small event, as he says, there is no Republican or Democrat way to fill a pothole. A mayor has to get things done on the ground. And so if you're interested in practical solutions, cities are where they're at. Not so much here, though. That's what we're trying to change. Yes, ma'am. So this is something we talk about a lot, right? We don't want to just be the purveyor of happy news. We want to, like, still point to problems, but then give equal weight to the solutions and ideas that can ameliorate the challenges that people have. That's a different nuanced point than what we see in media. Your point is well taken, that there's a steady drumbeat. This is now the third year in a row that our murder rate has gone up. I think it was 8%, 15%, and now it's up 9 or 12%. So that's under Jim Kenney, some type of 25% increase in murder. While, interestingly, other cities are not going up, they're decreasing, and our own violent crime is going down. So what I would argue is we need less of the sort of headline stuff that you're talking about, which is, you know, and by the way, there's an economic incentive for this. Channel 6, and I'm on, quick plug, I'm on Channel 6 on Inside Story, the Sunday morning public affairs show. My line on that is, you know a show is boring when you're on it and you're bored. But actually I do enjoy it. And the fact is that, why is that stuff on the air? Well, all you need is a police scanner and a camera. The police scanner says there was a murder at this address in North Philly, and you send a cameraman out, and that's the news, right? The chalk outline. You don't have to send a reporter. There's no issue, right? I don't think it serves any of us to put our heads in the sand about an exploding murder rate, but what we should be focusing on are the ideas that can ameliorate that murder rate instead of just the drumbeat of chalk outlines. So, for example, getting to the politics, no one asked Mayor Kenney, this under Michael Nutter, there was this successful police program called Focused Deterrence in South Philly. It turns out, criminologist at Temple has written about this, it turns out that the police know 80%, can tell you 80% of the murderers. They know them. They know who they are. It's a universe, right? So what they did in South Philly is they rounded them all up and had an intervention and said, if you guys do A, B, C, we'll do this for you, right? You have to be law-abiding, but we'll get you these services. And the murder rate and the violent crime rate in that district went way down like 3 years in a row. Why is this administration not funding it? They're only spending $135,000 on this program that seems to have worked and has worked elsewhere a lot. And the answer is because it was a Michael Nutter thing, right? And so Jim Kenney doesn't want to fund Michael Nutter's thing, he wants to fund his thing. It's this kind of small-mindedness that we've got to air in order to overcome it. And I think that's the narrative we need, not the drumbeat that just makes you feel unsafe, right? There was a professor at Penn, Gerber, is that his name? He passed away recently. He did a study about local TV news that found there exists something called the mean world syndrome, that if you watch a lot of local TV news, you are more inclined to think the world is meaner and more unsafe than it really is. So for us in the media business, we've got to figure out a way to make people hopeful while not fueling denial. I agree, and just think about if we took that same mindset across the board, right? We'd all be healthier and smarter and get along better. Yes, ma'am. That's a great question. So I get accused by the young staff at the Philadelphia Citizen of being grumpy a lot because I've been here a while. So I'm not optimistic, even though we're trying to fight the good fight. And I will say that something great happened in the last election, which was the courts took the electoral map and rewrote it and did it in the most fair-minded way, so that basically you have each, with a couple of exceptions due to density, each county elects their own congressional representative, which is how it should always have been, instead of these salamander-like districts. But because the census is 2020, that's going to be open again for political shenanigans. In Philadelphia, in particular, it doesn't feel to me like reform is in the air. I think this election showed that. This election was about city committee, the machine, and sort of a far left Bernie Sanders constituency running as upstarts. There were no reformers. There were no sort of practical problem solvers. Most of those lost. Like Aaron Sanamore ran for city council and didn't finish in the money. So I wish I had more of a positive response. But I will say that, and this is as positive as I can get, I think there is more of a desire among the electorate for something different. And I think the evidence of that was 2 years ago when Rebecca Reinhart stunned Philadelphia by winning the controller's race. And Larry Krasner to a degree, although I think that was more driven by ideology and more driven by George Soros's $1 million towards the end of that race. But Reinhart was a pure reform movement. And Philadelphia had 11 years of a golden reform movement. And then the hacks rose up again. And that was under Richardson Dilworth, the legendary mayor, and Joe Tate, was it? Joe Clark. Tate was the one who followed Dilworth. And then reform went away, and the machine rose again. So that's always a challenge here. Yeah. So check out the Citizen on our election guide, but also some other, Committee of 70 did a great job of that. WHYY did some great stuff. The Inquirer had a good guide, although lacking nuance. As is their wont. But on the issue of, so that's information, but on the issue of making it easier to vote, you're so right. We make it hard in this country. Why do we vote on a Tuesday? Why don't we have weekend voting? Why don't we have voting week? Why can't you vote on your phones? I can pay my credit card on my phone. There are a panoply of issues, and we've done a whole series on what some of these solutions are, including in Australia, they have 98% turnout. Why? Because voting is compulsory. Yes, ma'am. I don't know if I should congratulate you or offer my condolences. That's a great point. No, that's a great point. Yeah, no, you're a very half glass full person, so I appreciate that. You're right, and like, look, I'm in those two races. My enthusiasm was tempered by the fact that we shouldn't have these offices electable anyway, right? They should be appointed programs. They should be they're administrative offices, and that's how other cities and states do them. But you're right. That did say something. I appreciate that. Sure. That's That's great. That's great to hear. We got to get more of them to vote, and so spread the word, because when you're younger, you don't. It's not your primary focus. But yes, ma'am. And then we'll close out. That's, see, I think you've put your finger on the question of our times. Like, I'm a communitarian. I believe America built the most dominant economy in the history of the world in the 20th century because there was this ethos of all being in this together, right? As evidenced by things, by policies like the GI Bill of Rights, like Social Security, policies that were meant for everyone. The irony is when we talk about curing poverty, it's policies that are meant for everyone that has had the greatest effect on curbing poverty as opposed to policies that directly focus on the safety net. So I think this is a good place to end our talk because I think you're exactly right. We've lost a spirit of all being in this together, a sense of we can't even agree on the same facts anymore. Right.
We all watched it all at the same time.
That's right. That's right. And you know who really benefited from that? Teddy Kennedy, because it was the same weekend as Chappaquiddick. just a little bit of trivia. But you're absolutely right. A shared American experience. One of the things that drives me crazy is there's a lot of things about our current president that are frustrating. He never talks about American values like freedom and opportunity. These are ideas that linked us all together through the millennia, and it's not part of the conversation anymore. And I think as to how I'll leave you with this. Does anyone know who Steve Brill is? Steve Brill started this thing last year, which we're gonna invite him here for an event. It's called, oh my goodness, what's the name of it? Do you remember the name of it? It's Steve Brill started American Lawyer, author, publisher. It's a app that can help you decipher fake news from real news. And basically what he did is he hired a staff of professional journalists to go through every website everywhere and grade them on in terms of green light, yellow light, red light. Because one of the things you're talking about is we can't even agree on a underlying set of facts, right? If you watch MSNBC and then go over to Fox News, it's two different countries, right? It's like a civil war. And so what Brill's idea is, which I think is brilliant, is let's at least agree on an underlying set of facts. And then if we disagree, we're at least disagreeing over in a rational way. So check that out. And actually, go to The Citizen, and we wrote something about him. Google Steve Brill. I really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you so much.